sexuality studies at Barnard College at Columbia. She's a member of the Columbia chapter of the American Association of University Professors. She's also a member of the faculty and staff for Justice and Palestine. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Professor Rebecca Jordan-Young, let's begin with you. Your response to these hearings yesterday.
My response is, well, first, let me just thank you for the opportunity to talk with you. It's so important. My first response is that what happened at those hearings yesterday should be of grave concern to everybody, regardless of their feelings on Palestine, regardless of their politics. What happened yesterday was a demonstration of the growing and intensifying attack on liberal education writ large. So there was an opportunity yesterday for President Shafik to come forward to mount a robust defense of the university as a unique site for a debate of difficult ideas, for the fact that slogans can't be reduced to sound bites, that in fact, that what happens at the university is deep discussion, deep thought, and that, in fact, instead, what we got was a live performance of her not just throwing protesters and specific professors under the bus, which we somewhat anticipated, as awful as that was, but in fact throwing the entire university system under the bus, throwing out established policies and procedures of the university, throwing out rules that have been established by the American Association of University Professors for decades as best practices, actually announcing unilateral decisions on faculty members on live television, which she doesn't actually have the authority under the university to do. And I could say more, but really I was astonished. It went worse even than any of us had expected.
So, Professor Nara Milanish, if you could also respond, what most struck you about the hearing and what Professor Young just said, that the debate, rather than it being a debate about difficult questions, it became extremely narrow, and Columbia President Shafik seemed to capitulate almost entirely, as Professor Young said, through the entire university apparatus under the bus. If you could respond to that, what was your sense?
So my sense, one of the things that I learned is that congressional hearings are kind of like social media, which is to say they are wonderful places for political performance, for political theater, for sound bites, for gotcha moments, for interrupting one another. They are really terrible spaces to have deep debates about serious and contentious issues. And academic freedom is one of those issues. What goes on campus and what is happening on campus right now is one of those issues. Where my freedom to speak ends and your right to be free of harassment begins, those are really difficult questions. And a congressional hearing, Twitter, are not the places to be litigating these issues. The place to be talking about these issues is on college campuses, in classrooms, in university quads, in dorm room hallways, right? Universities are precisely the place where we should be having these deep and difficult conversations. And instead, we have seen time and again that university administrators are ceding this conversation to people who have very different motives, right? And who are engaging on these issues for very, very different reasons.
And if you could talk, Professor Young, about the establishment of this congressional committee to begin with and what we saw happening in December, which led to the resignation of two of the presidents of the top universities in the U.S.
Well, I think it's been clear from the very beginning that this task force, that this committee was actually never about anti-Semitism. This was about a broad attack on liberal education. And, you know, we have many people on this committee who've never before expressed any concern about anti-Semitism. And what we saw was that anti-Semitism, or the a particular interpretation of that, a very precise, very politically aligned interpretation of that, has been procedurally split off from discussion about all other forms of harassment, discrimination, violence, et cetera. And this is really contrary to what we do in the university. Certainly, it's contrary to what we do in my field, where broadly, this has been created and used as an opportunity to attack all forms of liberatory critical scholarship. It's been a place where critical race studies have gotten attacked. It's attacking DEI. And throughout, unfortunately, the university presidents who've been questioned, and yesterday President Shafiq among them and the rest of the members of the Columbia leadership, played along with this willingness to split these groups apart. But it's absolutely against what we do both in scholarship and justice activism. We try to help students understand the intertwined nature of systems of power and oppression and discrimination.
So if you could say, in the past, how has Columbia University, in other instances of harassment for other reasons, how has Columbia University dealt with those complaints of harassment, persecution, et cetera, by students or by faculty?
Well, there are disciplinary procedures in place and have been for a very long time. And they involve members from all sectors of the university that both develop the policies and who are involved in adjudication of particular complaints. What we've seen happening in the run-up to this particular hearing is it looked like the university was doubling down or tripling down on just how much surveillance and policing they could demonstrate ahead of time to say, look, we are a surveillance campus. We're a law and order campus. There won't be protest on the university campus. Columbia has historically been a center of protest and free speech, which is essential for our role as preparing students to be active members of a democracy. And instead, what's happening now is an arrogation of the right to decide all of those procedures just at the level of the administration, to actually treat protest itself as dangerous and as violent, which is really, really bone-chilling to me. The other thing that they've done is actually outsource a lot of the investigations and the hearings, especially that our students have been subjected to law firms and private investigation firms that are not in any way aligned with understanding the mission and the history of the university as a site for deep and principled disagreements.
I wanted to go to Democratic Congressmember Ilhan Omar, one of only two Muslim Congress members questioning Columbia President Shafiq.
Have you seen anti-Muslim protests on campus?
I have seen. We have had pro-Israeli demonstrations on campus.
No.
But
just
not
a protest that was
not
against Muslims.
No, I have.
Have you
not
seen one against Arabs?
No, I have not.
Have you seen one against Palestinians?
No, I have not.
Have you seen against one against Jewish people? Have you seen a protest saying we are against Jewish people?
No, I have seen.
Okay, thank you for that clarification. There has been a rise in targeting and harassment against anti-war protesters, because it's been pro-war and anti-war protesters is what it seems like, correct?
Correct. There has
been. Thank you.
So that's Congressmember Ilhan Omar, one of two congresswomen, Muslim congresswomen in the House in January. Congressmember Omar also in this hearing brought up the attack on pro-Palestinian students in January who say they were sprayed with a foul-smelling chemical. Eight students were reportedly hospitalized, complaining of burning eyes, headaches and nausea and other symptoms. Organizers allege the attack was carried out by two Columbia students who are former members of the Israeli military, using a chemical weapon known as skunk that the Israeli military and security forces regularly deploy against Palestinians. Professor Young, if you can comment on that incident of what happened and what happened to these students.
Yes, absolutely. First, I'll just say that in the 1980s, when I was an undergraduate, I was an organizer against, and I was an anti-apartheid organizer, and I was involved in a lot of demonstrations on my campus. My colleague students all around the country were faced with a lot of condescending policies and a lot of pressures from administrations and crackdowns. Never, ever have I seen something like what happened on the Columbia campus. Never, first of all, have I seen a situation where the administration sets up students to say that protests themselves are problematic. You can't be against a war. You can't be against indiscriminate bombing of civilians. I mean, what's getting lost in this is the situation in Gaza. And at the same time, what we saw is that the university did not respond to that attack on our students. Students were never contacted. The students who were actually attacked with that chemical weapon were not supported until after the fact, after intense pressure from faculty. The administration said that they would offer them some resources, but they also said that students who were subject to this skunk attack would not be exempt from the sanctions imposed on them for protesting. And I also think it's important to say that these policies against protest are not longstanding policies. They're new policies that have been created on the fly, sometimes after the fact of particular demonstrations. And the inquiry hearings that are being held are getting more and more draconian, so that there's a dragnet, basically, of sweeping up all kinds of students that they target, often because of wearing hijab, often because of being near other students, being friends with students who are protesting. So it's sweep everybody up, ask questions later. And it's, again, it's so chilling to me.
And Professor Milanesh, in your open letter that you wrote prior to this hearing to Columbia President Shafiq, you said it's absurd to claim that anti-Semitism is rampant on Columbia's campus. So why do you think that so many people are convinced that this is the case? And as Professor Young said, nothing like what's happened at Columbia has happened in the past with protests. How do you understand why this has happened?
Yeah, so I think this is a really important question. And I had the opportunity to author this open letter to President Shafiq in advance of her testimony with almost two dozen of my colleagues who identify as Jewish. And it's important to know here that Columbia has a large Jewish population of Jewish faculty and Jewish students. But there is no such thing as a Jewish opinion, right, on campus. This is a really heterogeneous group, a diverse group, people with very different experiences, different identities, and different politics, different ideas, different relationships, or even non-relationships with Israel, right? And we had the sort of impression, the sense that people were speaking for us, right? People were assuming that we needed to be protected, that we felt vulnerable, people assuming that we all shared a particular political point of view. And we wrote this letter to President Shafiq to clarify that, to explain sort of the diversity of different political opinions on campus, and to question this idea of a single hegemonic Jewish position or voice or experience. And the letter goes on to implore President Shafiq not to capitulate to this kind of politics of weaponizing anti-Semitism. One of the remarkable things that we have seen in recent months since the fall are the ways that right-wing politicians have suddenly discovered, they've had a come-to-Jesus moment, and have discovered Jews, and have discovered the scourge of anti-Semitism. And of course, many of these folks are people who flirt with white nationalism, right, in their everyday life, which is to say with actual anti-Semites, right? So we wanted to make the case, and that my colleague has made as well, that anti-Semitism here is being used as a wedge. It's being used as a Trojan horse for a very different political agenda, and that is a broader and deeper kind of desire or effort to insert politics into the university. So we can see how right-wing politicians, even yesterday on display in the congressional hearings, have a bigger agenda, a bigger axe to grind. They are interested in undermining academic freedom, in attacking wokeism. This is not about anti-Semitism so much as attacking areas of inquiry and teaching, whether it's about voting rights or vaccine safety or climate change, right? Arenas of inquiry that are uncomfortable or inconvenient or controversial for certain groups. And so this is essentially what we're seeing, anti-Semitism being weaponized in a broad attack on the university. And I think that's really worrisome. And we're all sort of looking to November to think about what happens then. I mean, if this is what is going on now, what happens if Trump is reelected? And then we get these inclinations coming not just from Congress, but also from higher up.
Well, we want to thank you both for being with us. Nara Milanich is a professor of history at Barnard Columbia. She co-wrote the open letter to President Manoush Shafiq titled Jewish Faculty Reject the Weaponization of Anti-Semitism. We also want to thank Professor Rebecca Jordan-Young in the Department of Women's, Gender and Sexuality Studies at Barnard College, Columbia, member of the faculty and staff for Justice and Palestine. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. As Columbia University President Shafiq testified before Congress about accusations of anti-Semitism at the school, Democracy Now! Spoke to Columbia and Barnard College students yesterday who set up a Gaza solidarity encampment early Wednesday morning with dozens of tents occupying the south lawn of the campus outside the main library. As we broadcast, students have been threatened with suspension and discipline action, but are still refusing to leave until their demands are met. They spoke about what they're calling for.
Down, down with occupation!
My name is Mariam Alwan, and I'm with Columbia SJP, Students for Justice in Palestine, and we are here today to demand that Columbia divest immediately from all stakes in Israeli apartheid. Over 33,000 Palestinians have been killed, and as we speak, our president is testifying in front of the House in a game of political theater that is conflating anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism. We want to focus the attention on what's going on in Gaza and tell Columbia that we are not going anywhere. No matter how much government suppression we face, we will keep fighting until they divest. They have been completely repressive. I mean, we faced police brutality. We have faced countless policy changes. I mean, my group, along with Jewish Voice for Peace, was suspended in the fall semester completely illegitimately. I filed a lawsuit to counter that action. And it seems like the repression is only getting worse and worse and worse. But the more they repress us, the more we rise up, and that's why we've escalated. That's also why we've escalated here today. Not only are they not listening to us when we peacefully protest, when we attempt to just pass referendums for student voices to even be heard, they don't even want to listen to the students. They don't want to know what the students think. And so we're here to tell them that we will take up space and presence on this campus, and they're not going to be able to erase our support for Palestine.
What do we want?
Justice!
When do we want it?
Now!
If Rafa doesn't get it!
My name is Soph. I am with Jewish Voice for Peace at Columbia, and I am here today because I will not stand by while thousands and thousands of people are dying because of our tax dollars in this country, as Columbia's money is going towards a genocide. The money that should be funding our education is going to the bombs that are dropping on Gaza right now. Columbia is a majority share. It has massive amounts of shares in various organizations like Lockheed Martin that are supplying Israel with bombs right now, and we will no longer be complicit. In a campus like this that is filled with repression, that is every day we wake up and the administration tries to silence us more and more, we are here to say the more you try to silence us, the louder we will be. We will not be complicit. We will stand in solidarity because we know that we keep us safe. We refuse to believe that Israel is in any part related to our Judaism. In fact, our Jewish values inform why we're here, why we're standing in here. Jewish values of tikkun olam, of love, of appreciation, of respect, of mutual liberation. And so as Jews, we are here to say that we will always support the liberation of Palestine, because that is what historically Jews have done. We have stood up for other oppressed peoples because we know that there can be no freedom until we are all free.
Free! Free Palestine!
Free! Free Palestine!
Palestine.
My name is Sarah Boris. I'm a student at Barnard College, and I'm here because I was raised as an anti-Zionist Jew. It is important for me to stand with Palestine. I go to a university that is actively profiting off of the genocide of Palestinians and then is hiding behind Jewish students by saying that they want to crack down on us because of anti-Semitism. But as an anti-Zionist Jew, I know that that is the farthest thing from the truth. They are doing that because they know that we are on the right side of history, that they are doing something that is profoundly wrong, and it is our job during this genocide to come out and resist. There were Jews protesting against this genocide who were harassed and then attacked with a chemical weapon that is not being addressed. This is, quite frankly, we're seeing McCarthyism once again. And our administrators need to be aware of the experience of anti-Zionist Jews, the way that anti-Semitism is being weaponized in order to crack down on this movement.
Voices from the South Lawn of Columbia University, where students have set up a Gaza solidarity encampment. Special thanks to Democracy Now!'s Hannah Elias and Tamari Astudio and Eric Halverson for that report. When we come back, we go to Tel Aviv, Israel, to speak with a senior Israel analyst for the International Crisis Group about why Israel-Iran war is a lifeline for Prime Minister Netanyahu. Back in 20 seconds. My Voice by ML. This is Democracy Now! I'm Imi Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Israeli forces have killed at least 11 people, including 5 children, in strikes on the southern city of Rafah. Israel has repeatedly attacked the city ahead of an expected ground invasion. There are new reports the Biden administration has approved Israel's plan to attack Rafah in exchange for Israel not launching counterstrikes on Iran. The latest article by our next guest is headlined, Why Israel-Iran War is a Lifeline for Netanyahu. In it, she writes, quote, just days ago, much of the world's attention was on the impending famine in Gaza and on Israel's failure to achieve its war objectives of toppling Hamas and returning hostages more than 6 months into the war. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was under pressure from U.S. President Joe Biden to allow insufficient humanitarian aid and reach a ceasefire, as well as appeals from Israeli protesters to seal a hostage deal and hold new elections. But at night, on Saturday, April 13th, all that faded instantly as Iran launched hundreds of drones and missiles at Israel in much-anticipated retaliation for an Israeli strike that killed senior Iranian military officials in Damascus, Syria on April 1st.
That article is by Merev Zonshein, a senior Israel analyst for the International Crisis Group. She's joining us now from Tel Aviv. Merev, thanks so much for being with us. Can you start off by just continuing your argument? Lay out what you think has happened in the last few days.
Thanks for having me. Well, essentially, we have an ongoing war for months and months that Netanyahu has orchestrated in a way that clearly he's talking about a total victory that most Israelis now understand is he's not able to achieve. He has lost a lot of legitimacy, both at home and abroad. At the same time, many Israelis have supported the war effort. They're in trauma. And so you have this chaotic situation. And just days ago, we started to see what looked like, at least rhetorically, cracks in what has been U.S. support for Israel's war effort in Gaza. And just as things started to seem to change a little bit, primarily as a result of an absolute humanitarian disaster man-made in Gaza, all of a sudden attention has gone elsewhere to another very worrying development with Israel and Iran. Now, I can't speak to Netanyahu's intent on the decision to strike the Damascus consular facility on April 1st. But what I can say is that when you've lost legitimacy and when former security officials and even some current ones are telling everyone that Netanyahu is not fit to lead and is not fit to be, you know, providing any kind of safety and security for Israelis, and then he takes a decision to strike a consulate, then that's clearly something that he took into account. In other words, it could have either led to nothing or it could have led to what we saw, and in which case he's now basically benefiting from the fact that all the world now has to kind of cooperate with him. The Western capitals, surely some Arab countries as well, have no choice but to kind of band together against this Iranian threat.
And Mehrav, could you explain your article before this one earlier this month is titled, "The Problem Isn't Just Netanyahu, It's Israeli Society." Explain what you mean by that and what you think the problem is with people focusing only on his being the head of Israel, Netanyahu, and taking all the decisions.
Right. Well, I mean, it's important to understand some of the nuances. I mean, basically, Israeli society is largely a right-wing society. It is a society that has not spoken about or thought about Palestinians or the occupation except when it's forced to. And it is a society that has gotten used to acting with impunity. After the Hamas October 7th attack, which was truly unprecedented for Israelis, there was huge consensus for the war. And there's been almost, you know, complete apathy to what's happening in Gaza. Israelis are not really interested or emotionally capable of handling that. And there's been a dehumanization of Palestinians for a very long time. So you have this kind of consensus and just support for Israel's war effort. At the same time, you have a leader, specifically Netanyahu, but also the far-right government in general, that many liberal secular Israelis don't support. And so you have a situation in which the Western capitals in the world that have pretty much unconditionally supported Israel have found a way to try and kind of split between, you know, criticism of Netanyahu, but supporting Israeli society at large. Now, I understand why they're doing that, but it's just important to understand that even if you took Netanyahu out of the equation and you put somebody else, some of his political rivals in the leadership positions, their approach to the Palestinian issue is almost identical. There's really no difference there. So the Israelis that are protesting Netanyahu now are not protesting him about his policies on Palestinians. They're protesting him about his attacks on their own freedoms and the fact that kind of the same human rights violations that Israel has been doing for years are now starting to seep into their own world.
Can you talk, Mehrav, about this possible trade-off that's being reported? Israel, U.S. wanting Israel not to attack Iran again, but they can invade Rafah.
I think all of this is largely theater and largely performative. I mean, basically, Israel has been dangling the threat of an invasion in Rafah for months now. It doesn't mean that I don't think it's something that it plans to do, but the U.S. pushback on it, while firm rhetorically, hasn't really been convincing. I'm not convinced that the U.S. is actually about to withhold aid or that the U.S. or Biden were actually going to stop Israel from invading Rafah because they are, largely support the war effort. And Israel is almost surely going to respond to the Iranian strike in some way. And it's understandable, you know, if we understand the ways Israel works, that it would do so. I think it's also understandable that Israel, you know, would now, since it hasn't already responded, it's now going to consider its options in how it can do that and how it can leverage that situation. So now, in effect, it has the benefit of being able to kind of dangle both threats. We're both going to attack Iran and we're going to attack Rafah. And so ultimately, those things are still the case.
We have to leave it there. Meir Avzanshine, senior Israel analyst for the International Crisis Group, will link to your piece in Foreign Policy. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh for another edition of Democracy Now!
Listen to music and podcasts from CGSF 90.1 FM with our radio app. It's on-the-go listening made easy. You can tune into all our music, spoken word, and multicultural shows using your device. Our app lets you set reminders so you'll never miss your favorite show again. Stay connected to CGSF 90.1 FM through our community radio app. Download the app from the Apple Store or get it on Google Play.
Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Radio Rewind. The following content has previously aired on CJSF. But don't worry, we'll be back next week with fresh content. CJSF 90.1 FM. Diverse. Independent. Yours.